take a minute to check your social battery. How's it doing? It's easy to ignore our needs and spread ourselves too thin. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/popcastpod today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/popcastpod.
Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your B in Saint-Tropez, never seen Leo of music, news, and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica. Bad, bad boy, shiny toy with a price, you
know that I bought it. Killing me slow. When have you been in Saint-Tropez?
Come on. Come on.
Fact check.
Wow. First of all, let me point you to the G-Unit XXL cover from 2006. It was Monte Carlo. It was close enough. Close enough.
Wow.
Karen Gans is here with the early drag.
Hi, John. It's been so long.
It has. Joe Coscarelli is here.
Mm-hmm.
John Perales is here.
In addition.
Why is the gang all here? Lover's out. Taylor Swift's seventh album came out on Friday. You know Voltron had to come together and really get it in. We open with Cruel Summer, one of the standout tracks on the album. If you have read my album review, I gave it a critic's pick. It did not come easily, I should say. Taylor at this moment is at a bit of a transitional moment, and it was unclear whether coming off of Reputation, which is an album I happen to really enjoy, but was not particularly successful by Taylor standards, it was a little unclear the direction she was going to go in and whether the shots that she was going to fire metaphorically and musically were going to land. I feel like they mostly did. Right off top, JP, what's your read on the album?
Well, this album's like...
First of all, JP been on vacation for about 4 months. So
he's coming at this with the clearest of heads.
Honestly, I can't imagine ears cleaner than JP's right now.
They are. The Q-tips are rocking. Well, to me, it's like Reputation never existed. That's what this album
true.
Is. It's like
true.
I'm forgetting my last album and you're going to think happy thoughts of 1989.
Does feel that way.
I don't know. I get some Reputation vibes.
You get a little ode to Reputation. Well, certainly the first song.
Yeah, but even beyond that, hang on. I mean, False Gods, I don't think that would have come in a non-Reputation ecosystem.
It needed Reputation to exist.
Yeah.
Well, Archie.
Where's your list of getaway cars?
I have it right here.
Okay, good. Karen made a list of all the songs that sound like getaway cars.
Which is her favorite song.
Yeah, which is my favorite song for Reputation. Happy that under the notes from our listening, my first note on Cruel Summer is getaway car number one.
All right.
So we'll continue on in that direction. Yeah. By the way, sorry, JP, continue.
I just think that Reputation was a weird, dark, strange, vindictive album, and it wasn't, as the country people love to say, relatable, because not all of us are superstars being trolled by social media.
Was it her metal machine music?
It was her difficult third album a few albums later.
Yeah.
But her problems on Reputation were about being a celebrity. Her situation on this album is being a girl in love, which mm-hmm. is a lot more generalized situation.
Joe, just earlier, before we came down, we were talking a little bit about Taylor getting knocked off of her axis, basically, in the Reputation era. And how, if you're really looking at it from, you know, 20,000 feet in the sky, that whole time period really affected her in a way that it didn't affect Kanye and Kim. Like, it's the sort of proportionate impact is much higher on Taylor.
Yeah, I mean, I think we all know how damaging social media can be to one's mental health. And obviously none of us can relate to the level that someone like Taylor Swift would experience that. And yet, when you think back on the summer that Taylor calls her apocalypse.
In the diaries.
In the diaries. And I think she mentioned in an interview as well. Mm-hmm. This was when Kim Kardashian released a clip on Snapchat of Taylor seemingly approving the lyrics to Kanye's Famous. Right. This all feels like a million years ago to me. And
yeah.
I think to most consumers of pop culture.
Totally agree.
I remember it as, you know, 18 hours of people who have long hated Taylor Swift or wanted to hate Taylor Swift feeling giddy that they finally had the proof
they had
that
evidence.
She was a snake for, you know, for the term that basically became the icon of this era. It's hard for me to understand just how impactful those few days were mm-hmm. for her.
Well, it's impactful enough that you make a song with Future and Ed Sheeran.
Right.
That's,
I mean,
I mean, that's
among many
that's
other
exactly,
things.
That's the exact measurement of how impactful it was.
And I would say, you know, the lead single from Reputation, Look What You Made Me Do, was obviously in reference to that situation. Arguably, the first track of this album is also a reference, if not a burying, maybe, finally, of that. But, and, you know, obviously this goes back 10 years now. We're at the anniversary of the Kanye Taylor VMAs moment, but just the amount of time and energy and emotional turmoil that these two, I want to say that these two have put each other through, but
it's not that.
It's not that. It's not Taylor that. Feeling this and Kanye
moving
feeling
on.
Whatever it is that he's feeling. I think, like, obviously it has not affected Kanye and Kim, who have plenty of other things to worry about, as deeply as it has affected Taylor. And this album feels a little bit like she's ready finally to put that to bed, but it's still lingering.
It is lingering, but I will say the thing that I was most struck by were that the notes on this album that felt most exciting to me were also among the most familiar. Reputation I liked a lot because the things that were good I thought were unfamiliar. She took risks. She took musical chances. She took on the quote-unquote bully, whatever it is. She fought back, which was not really Taylor's MO, at least not in a kind of macro sense, outside of the schematics of her personal life. The things that I really like on this album feel small, intimate, handheld, handmade. And that ultimately is why we all kind of enjoyed Taylor so much from 2006 forward.
But I think you would also say that we discussed this when you were writing your review, that we like these weird off-kilter moments again on this record, like Nice to Have a Friend. I feel like that could have maybe happened on 1989. But these, again, I still feel like these are post-Reputation experiments that might not have happened without it.
That's interesting. So you think that, okay, because I hadn't really thought about it in those terms. So you think that what Reputation did is open up the idea that Taylor could experiment with her sound. And so basically the experiments on this record, even though they are not the same kind of experiments, just the mere the fact of their existence.
Yes, I think it exploded.
Oh,
I mean, I felt like you said this in your review, so I feel like
I'm
cribbing from you a little bit.
Wow.
But I felt like Reputation exploded the idea of what she could be for herself and for us, and that I don't see her doing those little kind of thought experiments on previous records.
See, that's interesting.
But this album is like a Neatness Counts album. This is much, I mean, Reputation blew up the laboratory. Here she's like back in the laboratory being Taylor Swift, writing these narrative musical theater type songs, you know, dropping the cute little detail that makes the song but isn't really necessarily diaristic. She's also writing a lot about teenage emotions, about being the prom queen. She keeps returning to the metaphors of high school. And, you know, she's 29 years old. I got over high school, I think, in my 20s. So
who at this table is over high school?
I'm over it, but that actually is one of my critiques.
Yeah,
not over.
But when you were discussing her not getting over the Kanye thing, I was thinking about that. It's kind of like the thing that happens to you in high school that you don't get over. But she didn't really have a normal high school experience because she was becoming Taylor Swift at the same time.
Right, at age 13, as we find out from the diary entries, which I think we'll touch on more later.
Mm-hmm.
But I do feel like this album is a good mix of all of the post-Red Taylor Swift.
Yeah.
I think 2012 is full pop Taylor takes over, right? You get I Knew You Were Trouble. That seems to me like a big sonic division moment.
Yeah, that's the signature. I think there are two, I mean, we talked about
Never Getting Back Together is one thing.
Yeah, but I mean, there are two key musical ruptures. There's that moment, and then there is Reputation. Those are the real rupture points, sonically, for Taylor.
So I think if you take everything post I Knew You Were Trouble, and on Red, you still have some Fearless, and you still have some Speak Now moments where, you know, you get All Too Well, you get the really songwritery stuff. And I think this album is the first one to really mix those things seamlessly and take her old vocabulary and use her new sort of settings for it.
But do you think that all of those things happen on the same songs? Or do you just think that songs that are in service of both of those separate impulses just coexist a little more neatly than maybe they would have otherwise, or they did on Reputation?
I think they coexist in some songs, especially the biggest songs. So Cruel Summer, which we heard. Yep. I think we should play the bridge to Cruel Summer, which I think is one of the best moments on the album. Mm-hmm. And I think reminds me most of old Taylor working in new Taylor's mode. But the lyrics where she's talking about dialogue, and it's very filmic. And then she sort of does that scream from the background where she says, and he looks up grinning like a devil. Mm-hmm. And that's just like, to me, that's has the specificity and intimacy of old Taylor, but in a song that sounds like this.
And also, before we play that, one of the things that happens on Cruel Summer and a few other songs on this record, there's this multiplicity of Taylor voices. Like, we think a lot about artists in terms of their own internal grammar. This is something I think about with Drake a lot, how he's sort of always calling back to specific gestures of his that he's delivered previously. On this album, this song, and maybe two or three others, there are kind of like four or five Taylor, like it's meta Taylor, you know, there's four or five sub strains of Taylor work, all kind of like jammed into one song. But anyway, let's listen to that bit of Cruel Summer. I want to talk about the experimentation, and Karen, I think the thing that you're saying is really right, and let's maybe talk about Paper Rings for a second. This is probably my favorite song on the record, and we'll get to it in a second. I know, you know, we were having early conversations when we were listening to the record, and I kept joking it sounded like the Donnas.
Good reference.
Yeah. It's a little less guitar-y, but, like, ultimately, this is a pop-punk song or a punk-pop song, whatever, wherever you want to put the hyphen.
It is, with a dose of Grease, You're the One That I Want, in there.
Which is also a pop-punk song.
Even going back further, it's a girl group song.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Complete with wedding imagery, Chapel of Love.
And this is the thing. Taylor's public presentation is often referencing notes of chasteness. And
not on this album.
No. But generally speaking, but in terms of how she communicates to the world. And so it's interesting that the kind of most energetic, punchy, like alive song on this album is actually about weddings. It's completely taking a context that could be rowdy, that could be loose, that could be unhinged, but it's in service of this very kind of like ostensibly pure goal.
But it's also high schoolifying weddings, right? By being like, here is this thing I made for you out of a Starburst wrapper or whatever.
Hashtag ad.
Which is something that we did in school.
Check, hit Joe's Cash App. So, but anyway, this is, to me, let's listen to a bit of Paper Rings and everybody can go like do some cardio real fast. You're the one I want. I hate accidents except when we went from friends to this. Darling, you're the one I want. So a thing I thought a lot about on Reputation, and I think was probably the signature gap between what I felt about Reputation and what many other people felt about Reputation was...
Including some in this room.
Including probably... Yeah, fair.
Just you, actually.
But the thing that I felt most of the experiments worked, but I knew that they didn't wear well on Taylor. They didn't wear well on, especially if you were familiar with the work of Taylor Swift, positively or negatively, leading up to that album. Those things, it's like a suit that where like the tailoring was, no, that's, I shouldn't say the tailoring. It was like a suit.
Keep that in.
Yeah. The suit that doesn't fit quite right. I ended up really admiring it, but I understand why it was, number one, jarring to a lot of people and perceived as unsuccessful. So I spent a lot of time in the wake of Reputation figuring out, well, okay, if Taylor is not going to make Speak Now Fearless on a massive scale, if her pop stardom is not going to be shaped like that, what could her pop stardom be shaped like? What kind of song? She's not going to make Katy Perry songs. She's not going to make...
What is a Katy Perry song?
Well, apparently actionable. So she's not going to make songs like that. And I was wondering, what does Taylor... late 20s, early 30s in the pop space sound like? And Paper Rings is maybe the first time where I was like, oh, this is what a pop Taylor song sounds like. It's a little, it's a little naive. It's a little petulant. It has a kind of infectious back and forth energy that's communicated to fans.
I'm going to interrupt and strong disagree with you and say that that's what
I didn't even finish.
Pop Taylor sounds like Getaway Car, which is why that's what this whole album sounds like. It's a pop song. You could, he's glaring for those listening, which is everyone.
I'd edit you with paper rings. Yeah.
This does not sound like the something that can be replicatable for me.
Yeah, I don't know how many times
this is like
do
it's
this.
Just like a novelty song to me. I really like it, but
I want to hear eight of these on an EP.
Okay, I think you might be alone, JP.
No, I think one's enough. It's a genre exercise.
Yes.
It's a girl group genre exercise.
But
fine, she can do it. She's really good at it. She's really good at most things she puts her hand to. But you don't need another one.
But that is Taylor. This is my thing. That is Taylor genre. That kind of girl group sweetness. Like, that is something that Taylor has been carrying in her work from the very beginning. It's one of the few big tent centrist pop concepts that her skill set is actually naturally suited towards.
I will read your notebook where you trace this through her oeuvre.
Oh,
see,
it's the week before Labor Day. I don't need any more work.
I hear maturity and next phase Taylor more in songs like
London Boy.
Cornelia Street.
Not London Boy.
I feel like you're going to say Cornelia Street.
I was going to say Lover, Cornelia Street,
yeah,
and False God. I think that this is an interesting sort of like triad. Like Lover, you know. To me, it sounds like Rilo Kiley. People are saying Mazzy Star.
Yep.
But it's
Cowboy
sort of,
Junkies, too.
Yeah. So I think there are a lot of touchstones for this song. I think it has some old Taylor, to keep returning to that concept, like tastes, like little flourishes that remind you of Fearless or Red or Speak Now. You know, it still has that naivete that you're talking about that is like, you know, ultimately an optimism, mm-hmm, like a hopefulness, mm-hmm, in her music that I think was missing from some of Reputation, though I want to go back to how we remember Reputation in a moment. Cornelia Street, same thing,
yeah,
very specific, very confessional feels.
It felt mature, though.
Felt mature in a way that especially the singles from this album did not. They felt cloying, I think is a good word for it. You know, they were very broad.
A quick sidebar about the singles, something I thought about subsequent to writing the piece, but that really stuck with me, was we've all been to Taylor shows, right? Who's at Taylor shows? Besides
very young women.
Yeah, besides New York Times employees.
Very young women.
Yeah.
And mothers.
And gay men.
If you listen to those singles in sort of in isolation and think of them in that context.
That she's literally aiming one at each?
Not necessarily one at each, but that they're mostly... Me, which is a song I find irritating, is perhaps in a live context with a bunch of young kids.
No,
it sounds like a kids' pop song. It already sounds like a kids' pop
spelling
song.
Spelling is fun.
Oh.
Which is no longer on the album. Did you know this?
I did not realize.
They have removed Spelling is Fun from the album.
They Kanye'd it.
I have not gotten a straight answer as to why, but I'm very curious. Hit me on my DMs. If
we
you're a studio
know.
Engineer and you...
If you made the edit.
I think the only person who knows is Taylor. So.
But that's the thing. I mean, this album is trying to get back that teenage girl audience in a way Reputation wasn't.
Okay. So, this is where I'm going to do my little spiel on Reputation. We remember Reputation from...
Do you have this pre-written?
No.
Okay, because you're looking at your computer.
No,
like
I'm
you're
looking
reading.
At the track list.
This is like the teleprompter came out.
We remember Reputation. To me, the enduring... image, the palette of Reputation is the giant snake from the tour.
Yes.
And the Look What You Made Me Do video, which mm-hmm. is like in a graveyard or something, mm-hmm. as far as I remember.
Yes. I don't
it's
know.
Like lightning, you know, maybe like a castle, something, you know. Okay. Only side A of Reputation is like that. Only side A of Reputation is dark. Side B of Reputation is Getaway Car. It's gorgeous. King of My Heart. Dancing with Our Hands Tied, This mm-hmm. is Why We Can't Have Nice Things, Call It What You Want, New Year's Day. That's light, airy Taylor. That's her, it, as I remember that album.
Well, not This is Why We Can't Have Nice Things.
That's petulant, right?
Yeah.
That's petulant Taylor, yeah. But it's bright.
Musically.
Musically.
Yeah.
You know, the first half of that album is Kanye / Everyone Hates Me, and the second half of that album, you know, beginning with Gorgeous, is like Joe Alwyn, My Boyfriend, Saved My Life, basically.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. Let Me Try to Remember... You know, and I think it's notable that you end on New Year's Day, which
is, of course,
you know, an acoustic piano only beautiful song about what being only needing one person, right? So I don't
think that person is herself.
Right, that too.
Just putting that out there.
So I feel like when we remember Reputation, we're remembering half of Reputation, which is how it was.
Well, it was marketed that way.
And it was front-loaded in that way, and those singles, Ready For It, Endgame, I Did Something Bad, mm-hmm. Don't Blame Me, all that stuff is, I think, what will endure from that era. But I think she was already trying to get out from under it even while it was happening.
So, you know, well, first of all, should we listen to New Year's Day?
Sure.
Let's listen to New Year's Day.
Wow, we're really going back.
It's the anti-cardio.
There's glitter on the floor after the party. Girls carrying the shoes down in the lobby. Candle wax and Polaroids on the hardwood floor. You and me from the night before.
This podcast is supported by Washington.org. Washington, D.C. offers visitors so much to explore. Just ask Dayo, who shared her experiences from a recent visit.
What was your favorite food all weekend?
The Ethiopian food at Sihei.
And the first place you would visit again?
The bookstore, Little District Books.
What did you appreciate the most?
Really just like the genuine kindness of everyone that I encountered this weekend.
Why should people visit D.C.?
Well, D.C. is a place with such a thriving culture.
Washington, D.C. has something for everybody. Plan your next trip at Washington.org.
My name is Thomas Gibbsneff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with a first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
This new album does, in my mind, it begins with the ending of Reputation. The seppuku, you know, of Reputation.
Right. I forgot that you existed.
Yeah, which I don't want to listen to, and nor will I.
No, the album starts with Cruel Summer.
In my iTunes. Yeah. But yeah, I think that's all fair in regards to Reputation. But I do think, broadly speaking, the musical palette, and especially the Jack stuff that ends up kind of setting the table for some of what's on this album, there's something thicker, more pulsing. There's a kind of viscosity to it that I don't think was on the previous Taylor records. It certainly wasn't on the early Taylor records. And 1989, there's a kind of carefreeness on 1989. And I think whatever she kind of arrived at with Jack on Reputation, even in these kind of like non-theme songs, these off-theme songs, there was something about the thickness and the kind of the mood, like just basically the mood that, I mean, they're bright, but it's not as bright as like OG Taylor.
Well, don't you think also that that's the transition from Max Martin perkiness mm-hmm. to Antonoff weight?
Yes.
I mean, she switched producers. She wanted a different sound.
Mm-hmm.
She did both for a while.
Yeah, but she's moved away from and since we're back on Cruel Summer yet again.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Shout out to Annie Clark. Shout out to St. Vincent, mm-hmm. who's among the collaborators there, in part, I think, because of the St. Vincent song, Cruel.
Mm.
Is that St. Vincent song referenced directly musically on Cruel Summer? I didn't listen to them back to back.
If you listen to the chorus of Cruel and the chorus of Cruel Summer, it's sort of cruel upside down.
Mm-hmm.
It hops back and forth of third.
But you do think they're related?
Yeah.
So we should talk more broadly about the collaborators here.
Yes, although quickly, do you, Karen, you want to talk about the Slater Kinney album?
I was going to, but yeah. I'm just going to hold it in.
Are you sure?
Holding it.
It's a safe space.
Holding it in.
There's just four of us with microphones here. Yeah. You're more than welcome to talk about it.
Yeah, I've never said anything about Slater Kinney on a podcast that the band then mentioned to me later, so I'm not going to say anything.
Wow. Well, you know, I guess hit Karen's DMs if you want to know what she thinks about the Slater Kinney Annie Clark project. On to collaborators, then.
So as JP mentioned, this album is, for the first time since Red, free of Max Martin.
Yes.
And Shellback.
Who we learned in the diaries, Max Martin thinks that, or at the time, thought that Shake It Off was the best song he's ever worked on.
Yeah, he said that.
Can you see what emoji face I'm making?
The same Max Martin who said that Lorde's song was incorrect.
Can you see what emoji face I'm making?
Flat mouth emoji.
All right,
Jesus. All right.
Jesus.
It's a tough game.
Anyway, Max, if you're listening, we know you're lying.
This is the first podcast with an emoji.
That's true.
So Max Martin gets swapped out. Shellback, a Max Martin acolyte, gets swapped out.
Yep.
And I'd say in their place is the duo of Frank Dukes and Louis Bell.
Yeah. Joel Little also in there.
Joel Little, who had the first two singles, You Need to Calm Down and Me. He also did The Man, which we can get to later because I think that one split the room.
Ooh.
And then you have Frank Dukes and Louis Bell, who are best known probably for their Post Malone work at this point. They've also worked with Lorde.
Frank worked with Frank Ocean, you know.
And Drake.
Yeah,
and, yeah,
sure.
These guys are everywhere, but they're certainly what Max Martin was to the radio maybe when 1989 came out and just before that, guys like Frank Dukes
are
Louis
to
Bell,
to the Xanax era.
Are, yes, to this moment.
Yeah.
And so it's an interesting choice that Taylor sort of tags in these guys that are not necessarily at the cutting edge of what popular music sounds like, but are very much in the current foundation of what it is.
Yeah. Well, she does want to write hits. She's not exactly climbing out on an avant-garde limb.
So before we get to Jack Antonoff, who did the majority of the producing and the co-writing on this album, along with Taylor, who has a production credit on every song, I do wonder what you guys think Joel Little, Frank Dukes, and Louis Bell added to this project, if anything, and if they are a sustainable part of Taylor's stable moving forward.
Here's how their contributions made me feel, apart from The Man. I don't cook.
We know.
Or bake. But like, don't you need like stuff? Like there's like a thickener in some recipes, right? Like
a starch roux, or a thick- are you looking for?
No, there's something that's like
cornstarch.
It's called flour.
What if then even better? It's something designed to add stability and thickness, but not interfere with kind of fundamental taste energy of the thing. I think that there is something structural about the work that those guys are doing that's not really affecting the sound that much, except in a couple of isolated places. I talked about this in the review a little bit. I think we all really like specific Taylor. We all like detail Taylor. And if you look at lyrics that people, not Frank, who's a producer, but if you look at lyrics those guys have worked on, either on this album with a couple of exceptions and in their previous work, it's not very specific. It doesn't feel they are doing kind of like vague. They're doing outlines. They're not coloring in. They're doing outlines. To me, I don't think Taylor's future is in outlines. And if it is, I think something will be lost. So I'm not saying they don't stick around. I'm just saying I don't think they're central.
Who do we want to hear her work with? Is there like a Rick Rubin?
Drake.
No, producer-wise.
Drake.
40.
No, I don't
Take
know.
Heath.
I'm curious.
Self-produced.
Nick Mira.
Nick Mira.
Yo.
Yes. Internet money.
Internet money. Taz Taylor, Nick Mira, Taylor Swift. You heard it here first.
This is not what you actually want.
Yeah. Are you kidding me? You think I don't want to hear Taylor on a Nick Mira fake Juice WRLD
beat? You call
beat?
Her Taylor?
Yeah.
He did.
I'm just putting that out in the universe or whoever might be listening.
Well, Karen, you as the biggest fan at the table, I haven't pulled JP on this, but I'm going to safely assume you are the biggest fan of Miss Americana and the Heartbreak Prince, which is a sort of this extended high school metaphor question mark on this album, produced by Joel Little And co-written with him. So let's listen to a little bit of that and then tell us what about it works for you.
You like the Americana, Catherine?
What is happening?
Is your name Catherine?
No.
You like the Americana, Karen?
This whole podcast is going sideways fast. I love this song. I mean, I love the moodiness of it. I also, in my notes, by the way, it's getaway car number 3.
Even though it's not a Jack Antonoff song.
Yeah, which is confusing. Let me just scroll back for a moment to see what getaway car number 2 was. Oh, it was The Archer.
Mm. The Archer.
Yeah. Which actually did grow on me, too. But I liked Miss Americana, like, lyrically as just sort of like a fun thought experiment about bringing in the tropes of high school into a song like that, that I think we have agreed, you know, it was probably one of the songs in which she addresses America at large, you know, thus the name, some of the themes in it.
Yeah. Do we think the second verse of this song is about Donald Trump?
It's so vague.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not convinced, but I do think, I do agree that it's about more than high school.
And you and Karen, you and I talked about this before the review went up about should we mention, like, should we talk about, I think there's this and maybe one other spot on the album where there's kind of like a calling into question of the American dream or something. But it's so vague. And especially given Taylor's sort of legendary reluctance to engage with the current political climate.
Yeah.
It felt, you know, for me, I was like, I don't feel I'm on 100% stable ground to say this definitely is that. It feels like it's enough of a nod that if you want to read her that way, you can. But if you also are reluctant to read her that way, it's not so overt that you feel dragged into.
Let me just read those lines, because the more I think about it, the more I think it is certainly a reference to at least the state of the world.
Sure.
Well, right. You know, that's, again,
we'll take
broad,
a dramatic
but
reading.
Yeah,
she says, my team is losing, battered and bruising. I see high fives between the bad guys. Leave with my head hung. You are the only one who seems to care. American stories burning before me. I'm feeling helpless. The damsels are depressed. Boys will be boys. Where are the wise men?
But who's to say that's
darling,
not,
I'm scared.
Who's to say that's not about Ye?
I don't think that's about Ye.
I don't think it, but I'm just saying 80% of that could be on the first song.
Sure. I think it's there's plausible deniability at everywhere you look.
The mood of the song is just tremendously different. I'm leaning towards Joe.
I don't think that the metaphor is consistent, and I don't know that it works all the way through with the playing dice and whatever else is going on there.
We're just going to shoot CeeLo here real fast.
But I think that this is at least an attempt to move in that direction in a way that I think a few people have pointed out reminds me some of Lana Del Rey in this.
Yeah.
I think the mood of it and the idea
the mood
of it.
And the big ideas that are sometimes a little bit vague.
Yeah. I mean, there's also so many nods at like kind of like high school romantic comedy kind of a vibe on all the songs, but it kind of gels for me on this song. I don't love them everywhere else. You know, even in Cruel Summer when she's like running to the gate, it's like, yeah, sure, okay, fine. You know, like there's just how many imagined romantic movie scenarios she can come up with, but there's something a little darker and more twisted about this that I like a lot better.
Something about the Joel Little songs on this album, I'm thinking of Me, I'm thinking of The Man, and I'm thinking of this one specifically, The Bridge, where they do the go fight win. You know, which is a classic cheerleader chant, and she works it into the lyrics. They all feel a little bit reverse engineered to me. Like there are these clever things that they want to get to, and then they sort of fill in the blanks backwards.
Are you going to
so
tell
just
me
like every other pop song?
Well, I was going to say, what was clever about Me?
I'm not going there.
Okay,
but I'm. I think that you know.
Well, that's kind of. I mean, that's part of it. When I say it was like sort of like a songwriting thought experiment that they were going to take this high school trope and see it all the way through. I thought the go fight win thing is actually clever, and I thought it works.
Yeah, I mean, I go back and forth on it, but I do think there's a little bit of you can see them working this out in the song. It's not
seamless,
and I felt that way a lot about The Man, which
okay, we're gonna have to talk about The Man now.
Which just
I was
me,
just about to counter. You by saying except on The Man.
See, The Man, I get the same vibe, and I think.
Wait, JP, do you like The Man?
I like Beyonce's If I Were a Boy better and earlier.
I am dead. I am collapsed.
I like the man. So, Joe, you don't like the man.
Yeah, well, it's not that I don't like it.
I think it's intelligence. It's a message song. It's a song. I want to write a song about what my prerogatives would be if I were male.
It's funny.
I think it's funny,
It's
too.
Funny. Taylor is not funny. This is funny.
John and I are agreeing.
And this is the thing that I'm not saying
funny.
Taylor.
I don't think it's that funny.
I think it's funny. I think it's in good humor, but I mean, about all the sexism that she's faced, I felt like every line rang true.
Let's listen to the man.
I'd be a fearless leader. I'd be an alpha type. When everyone believes ya, what's that like? I'm so sick of running as fast as I can. Wondering if I'd get there quick or if I was a man.
I wanted it to be the same thing that I wanted You Need to Calm Down to be, which is, You Need to Calm Down is widely seen as the phrase that you should never tell a woman because a woman does not like to be told to calm down. So I thought she was going to take that phrase, turn it on its head, and then give you another half turn of cleverness to sort of reposition where this phrase fits in the culture. Now, the man I thought would be the same thing. The idea that if a woman was a man, she'd be called a player instead of a something less polite.
Familiar idea.
That's a very familiar idea, and that's what the song is about. There's no extra term.
But let me ask you this. If Miranda Lambert did this exact song, if Maren Morris did this exact song, we would think it was cool.
You're saying it's a country song.
Oh, well, first of all, there's like three country songs on this record. That's number one. We can get to that. But I do think fundamentally, I mean, the point that you made that I will acknowledge is I actually think this song was concept backwards, but it was video concept backwards. Because I think there's a video coming. Not that I have any knowledge of this. 2 months from now, 3 months from now, Taylor dressed like a man. You know, in male clothing.
Mm-hmm. All different kinds of famous men.
Yes.
She's The Rock. She's Leo. She's Barack Obama.
Exactly.
She's Scooter Braun.
Wow.
Whoa.
First of all, Taylor. Whoa. Wow. Damn. First of all, I'm please don't dress as Barack Obama. Please, if you're listening, don't do that.
This is a free concept you're handing her for her next video.
No, my whole career is free concept.
The problem with the concept and the song is that it's too straight face. It's too obvious.
No, I think it's directness.
I think it's fine. I think it speaks to an audience that for whom maybe this concept, it is the first time that they've engaged.
She does not voice her feminism that often. And actually, this might be a good opportunity to talk about. I was going to bring this up before, but I didn't want to ruin our flow. When you're talking about how the vibe we have of the lingering memories of Reputation are so negative and dark, I think a lot of that was because she didn't do press around that album.
Ooh.
And that a lot of the conversation around it was not within her control, and it was negative and dark. There was following, you know, just the singles, the stuff about the white nationalists trying to adopt her as a symbol and all these other things that she was kind of fighting. They were cloudy, negative things. But now we have a fresh press cycle and she actually is talking.
That is accurate. Dedicated podcast listeners and readers of the New York Times music coverage know that we have been haranguing Taylor for...
And many other musicians.
Not Taylor alone, but for not doing press. Broadly speaking, with anyone, this is a problem in pop music coverage in general. Once stars elevate past a certain level of fame, they often stop doing press, or at least doing press that they are not in control of. And this was a thing that Taylor did during that time period. Now, perhaps it was a rejection of the current journalistic model. Perhaps it was a desire to remain obscure as she was going through this traumatic cycle in her career and personal life. But I am relieved to say, at least, that we appear to have come out the other side of that drought with a couple of things. Laura Snapes interviewed Taylor for The Guardian. That came out a couple days ago.
She's on the cover of September Vogue. She did the CBS Sunday interview.
Shrug, whatevs. but at least that's two sustained, like, long-form interviews. I think of the two, The Guardian is more successful than the Vogue one in terms of what it says, in terms of how much Taylor speaks.
I think in terms of how much music the writer had heard.
Yeah, I mean, they were definitely done 3 or 4 months apart, it seems. And I will say in The Guardian story, you do see her touching on kind of all the things that for the last 3 years, if you were keeping a running whiteboard list of need to know what Taylor thinks about dot, 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 blank, 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 it's all in there. She calls the current presidential administration an autocracy. She addresses directly her support for LGBTQ rights and kind of how that had been an open question. She wasn't aware it was an open question. A lot of subjects are touched on. And I think for those of us who value an independent press in the celebrity arena, I'm relieved to see that.
Though I felt that, you know, having gone so long without answering those questions, a lot of the answers came off as practiced,
yeah.
Or at least, you know, they echo things that she's been sort of saying on Instagram or in things she's written herself over the last few months or quotes that she's given here and there.
That doesn't bother me, though, because, I mean, once you figure something out, once you figure out what you want to say, you repeat it. There was another good quote in there, which I'm going to misquote, but she basically said, I think it's hard for someone like Taylor Swift, who is every move of her life scrutinized. She says, you know, I want to express myself, but I don't want my life to be a reality show. And I
well,
think,
that's also a shot at somebody else.
Yeah, it's a shot, but it's also, I mean, it's a hard thing to balance. And I thought that was a good way to explain it, even though it may have been a canned line. She's right. I mean, do you really want to live your life like a reality show?
And I think that goes back to why the Kanye fights have been so enduring for her, is that those are the things, along with her early romances, that made her life most like a reality show. She literally got pulled into a reality show in the case of the Kardashians.
Yes. And I think it's interesting because, when you think about the Joe Alwyn relationship, one of the diary entries is from 3 months into that relationship. And it's about basically bunkering down in London with him, trying to kind of cocoon off and protect this thing. And it's strange that, you know, Taylor pre-Kanye Kim explosion was living a very public romantic life, was choosing or not. I don't know what the behind-the-scenes mechanics are, but it was very public. That was not sufficient for her to retrench and kind of retreat from. But the Kim and Kanye stuff, I think, made her reassess all of it in, like, one big batch. And so it's interesting that you get this diary entry that's basically like, okay, now I get it. Now I can completely go off-grid, or at least that's the only way I can have sanity at this point.
Are there other things in the journal entries that you guys would like to highlight?
So the journal entries that we've been touching on throughout this conversation.
Can I just say what a joy it was to discuss the journal entries with Joe Coscarelli?
We spent Sunday night in a Google Doc.
So fire. Like, honestly, what am I going to do better? In 2019, what am I going to do better? Hootie and this.
We should.
You guys know how to party. I got to say.
That's a true story.
We're having a good year.
We should publish our notes.
Oh, the raw notes?
As our journal.
Well, in the special edition of podcast. Yeah. The podcast is coming out.
So Taylor Swift Lover comes in 4 special editions exclusively at Target. Woo. Not a sponsored post.
No, and also not at the Target on 34th Street where it's been sold out.
And each one has a unique book. There are 4 versions that have selections from Taylor's childhood, teenage to 20-something journals.
Yeah, they're like 2003
to 2017.
Yeah.
And they are a lot. There's a lot of information in there.
Carefully calibrated, curated, and triggered information.
And in the same way that this Guardian interview with Laura Snapes touches on all of the different themes and questions that you've had for Taylor over the last 2 to 3 years, these diary entries do that for a much broader period, probably a decade plus, right? There's Kanye, there's Scott Borchetta from Big Machine, who she's recently beefed with. There's more subtle stuff that, like, you caught the John Rich thing.
Yep.
She talks about going to label auditions at age 13. Mm-hmm. She talks about her problems with dieting and food, which is something we haven't heard a lot from her about over the years. You know, there's Grammys and there's just a lot of information.
But it is chess. I mean, this is the thing. It's high level chess. Right. And this is the thing that I think we agreed on but felt differently about. I was very struck by how on the nose each page felt. There was not a wasted page. Now, look, this is a person who's like extremely diligent about her public presentation. You would never listen to a Taylor album and be like, that's a wasted song, that's a wasted note, unless it's London Boy, in which case that's a complete waste and it should not be on any
record. Afterglow in that category, but keep going.
Hey, Afterglow.
Yeah,
fine.
I'm coming around on Afterglow. You want to listen to a little Afterglow?
No, keep going.
Okay.
Keep going.
So the meticulousness of it obviously should not come as a surprise. But I did feel like when with the Borchetta stuff, I was very struck because obviously all the entries are from when she's 13, 14 years old, or I think during the Red era. The Red era, yeah. Also. Borchetta seems like a great guy. And what a thing to do to a person who has just publicly slighted you than to basically be like, you used to be cool. I remember when you used to be cool.
Or through the eyes of a child, you appeared an honorable man.
Right. And then, but to include them is, I mean, that's actual shade. This is a thing that Taylor has not, a concept she did not perfect in other contexts, but in this context is dead on. Every page either was the conclusion of an old thing, a transition point in a current thing, or a table setter for what may be a future thing. You talked about the body image stuff and the dieting. You're right. This isn't a thing we've heard Taylor engage with a lot. And I wondered, by including those things, is that something that's going to be discussed more moving forward?
Definitely, because I think it's mentioned in the list she did for Elle, you know, ahead of her 30th birthday. She said, 30 things I've learned, whatever. And one of them was something about, you know, eating what she wanted and being comfortable with the body she had. And something that we've seen in this Taylor rollout more than in any other before is that every single thing is foreshadowed. It's like Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, the Tarantino movie, in this sense, where like everything you see in every photo she posted or every interview she did or every essay she wrote.
There's an Easter egg.
Is an Easter egg, right? Yep. I struggle with them being called Easter eggs because they're so one-to-one. Like, it's not a hint. It's just the thing, you know? Like, she's wearing a Dixie Chicks button and a Cruel Summer button on the cover of Entertainment Weekly. Those things are all either alluded to or included on the album. It's just, you know.
Do you think there's a buried Drake collaboration somewhere?
No, I think the Drake thing was just in my feelings.
I'm saying independent of that.
Do I think they've been in the studio together before? Yes. Is there a finished song? I don't know.
Like, is there anyone on Discord who can get me those files? Like, I just want to know.
What song from this album would you put a Drake verse on?
Ooh.
And I'll just invert own answer, which is I want to put a Taylor song back on Summer Games from Scorpion.
Wow.
Which is the Archer part one.
Wow.
Let's play a little bit of Summer
Games. Let's go.
Yeah. You say I led you on, but you follow me. I follow one of your friends, you unfollow me. Then you block them so they can't see.
All right, but for your game, I think I would say False God.
You think Drake could go on False God?
I do.
Cornelia Street.
No.
Can we answer the question?
Wait, let's have JP.
I want JP's answer.
I go with False God. I think you're right.
Just because of the sax?
No, there's a vibe. And the syncopation.
I think False God does this thing. We should talk about this because this also, to me, feels like adult Taylor in a way that we don't often get. I think there was some, for lack of a better word, sexy time music on the previous album, Reputation. Look, I don't know how else you want me to talk about
Christ.
This.
Oh, my Lord.
Dress.
Everybody.
Yes.
We all remember Dress.
Everybody go walk around. Everybody take five.
We all remember Delicate.
Yep. Yes, we remember. Yes, we remember. Yeah.
This is a song where Taylor Swift, Princess of America, says that her hips are an altar to be worshipped at. And it works.
It's like a Lizzo record.
And it works.
Lizzo, it does work.
It's Lizzo featuring Cupcake.
It's not something we would have expected to work from Taylor, and yet.
Okay, I'll just grant you that because, like, honestly, all I want to do right now is hear the bridge of Cornelia Street and imagine Drake picking up the melody delivering a verse right after.
We can't move backwards, John. This podcast has moved on.
No, we're going to hear the bridge of Cornelia Street right now. And everybody, I want you to imagine in your mind Drake doing counterpoint melody on this.
Maybe Pedro will take pity on us and not play that cue.
Karen, I just have three words for you. Sip, sip, joy. Please.
You hold my hand on the street, walk me back to that apartment.
Okay, now that you all have engaged in the thought exercise about how Drake would best fit in on this album, let's talk about someone else that was acknowledged on that EW cover. It's Dixie Chicks. Soon You'll Get Better is, Look, there's maybe three, in my mind, there's maybe three country songs on this album, but Soon You'll Get Better is like the very obvious country song. It's interesting, in the Guardian interview, Taylor talks explicitly about when she was a young country singer, basically being told to avoid politics so you don't get Dixie chicks'd. Is that even a way to say it? But
yeah,
sure.
Yep.
And it is, I mean, it's the What Happened to the Dixie Chicks is a real precursor to the contemporary culture wars. It's sort of inverse of current cancellation. It's inverted cancellation coming from the other political side in the other direction. This was the power that a certain political viewpoint, the sway that it held in country music in the early to mid 2000s. The Dixie Chicks, for those who don't remember, were hands down one of the most popular, forget country artists, popular music acts of the 90s into the early 2000s. Wide Open Spaces is one of the best albums of the last 50 years. The Dixie Chicks basically, within the space of about a week, got washed out of all the popular music because they said something deemed unpatriotic about President Bush. When you think of the number of things, the number of kind of ongoing cancellations that happen every day in contemporary Twitter culture, this seems almost laughable because it's so, relatively speaking, small. But at the time, it really shaped not just the end point of the Dixie Chicks' career, it also set the table for what country music was going to embrace and sound like for the duration of the decade. A lot of the things that are perceived as radical in country music in the 2010s only seem radical because for about 6 or 7 years, country music didn't move. Country music stayed very fundamentally the same. And it took ultimately Taylor and post-Taylor, Sam Hunt, Kane Brown, like all of these acts who couldn't have existed in 2003 or 2004 in country. Soon You'll Get Better is a country song. And, you know, in the review I wrote, it's like flirting with an ex. It's very effective. It's uncomplicated. It's easy. And I think very moving. It's about Taylor's mother who has cancer, but Taylor embracing the Dixie Chicks. Not that Taylor is the most centrist or valid country artist right now, but embracing the Dixie Chicks, bringing them in from the cold, that's a potent symbolic gesture.
I would say the Dixie Chicks got brought in from the cold when they won all those Grammys for their album after the George W.
But that was like with the Semisonic guy.
Yeah,
like,
that's not a different thing. I'm just saying. And the Dixie Chicks will be back. They're working on an album too.
I'm sure all slappers. I'm sure.
Right. I will say I do think this is another thing about Taylor and her Easter eggs. I think it's not a coincidence that the first time she's putting the Dixie Chicks on an album is also coinciding with the first time she's speaking politically and then explaining it by saying, I didn't in the past because I was raised by country music.
Absolutely.
And these things are all triangulated in a very savvy way, frankly.
100%.
100%. Not to mention, again, Jack Antonoff is the sort of common thread here, right? He's a frequent collaborator with St. Vincent, who appears on the album. He's been working with the Dixie Chicks on their forthcoming album. He's, you know, been Taylor's most consistent collaborator since 1989, and he's the biggest voice here musically that's not Taylor.
Yeah. The thing that I noticed about the Jack songs on this record, and certainly what Karen was talking about Getaway Car number 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, is there is an idea that they've arrived at. And that's not saying, because there are other, I think Paper Rings is a Jack song. Yeah, I mean, they're exploring other spaces, but they do have a fundamental rhythm and texture that they've achieved. Sound like children, movies where children discover fantasy worlds.
Is that what you wrote?
Yeah, that's what he wrote. Yeah. It was good. Yeah. Good line.
Which is, to me, most interesting because Jack's music with Taylor sounds the most like Jack's music without Taylor when compared to his other collaborators. To me, you know, he produced Lorde's Melodrama along with Lorde. That album is very...
It's a
Lorde
album.
You know, it has Jack moments, I think. You hear, you know, his most recent band, Bleachers. They have 2 albums. You can go back to those albums and hear a lot of the ideas that are sprinkled throughout the Lorde album, the St. Vincent album, this upcoming Lana album. I think you probably hear Jack the least that you've ever heard him in terms of his sort of signatures. Whereas Taylor, I think, takes a lot from him.
Yeah.
You know, she does the thing that he does vocally where he goes up at the end of a line, at the end of a phrase. Right.
You picked a long line.
I think she was doing it before. I think she was doing it before, but I think...
Because I think of that as a Taylorism, actually.
Right. So this is where eventually, this is what I'm getting around to, which is that I think a lot of the things that I think of as Jack things, going back to his work with Fun and even before that, have now become Taylor things. And she's, you know, taken them into what she was already doing, made them more Taylor. And certainly, like she does with everything, she just comes through stronger than everyone else. I don't know that any of the sounds she's using on this album or the past few, it just to me feels like she's trying them on. And what endures is Taylor's voice, Taylor's lyrics, Taylor's presence. And I think she will continue to be her with or without these guys. And I don't know how much legacy these sounds will have or how much they will be part of her legacy.
Well, that's interesting because we were talking about the Frank, Joel, Louis stuff earlier and how there's something kind of structural but inessential about them. But I don't know. I do think that something about the texture of what Jack does has pushed Taylor to a slightly different lyrical place. There is a little bit more abstraction. If you think of the kind of breathing space on early Taylor records, part of the reason there's breathing space in the production is I think that her lyrics are so detailed. And there wasn't anyone in the room that was like, we're going to get in the way of this. This is the selling point. This is what she's great at. I do think working with Jack, someone who has like a much more established and structured sonic identity, I think that she has started to paint within those frameworks. And I think that's why, and this is something I know we've all talked about at different points, the lyrics, generally speaking, have become less specific. They become more in service of cadence and rhythm and like one thing I know is that she smears syllables out a little bit in a way that would never have happened on album one or album two. And obviously you don't want to hold people to what they did when they were 17 years old. I'm just trying to emphasize that one of the things that she has learned to do is to fit within a slightly restrictive framework. And I do think that has been the penalty of that has been the specificity of the lyrics.
I think it's interesting that that is what you believe the final takeaway to be, because I think, you know, having spoken to Jack and his collaborators about how he works,
Flex.
He's very much a, no, I mean, you know,
he's coming,
we all have the same job.
Yeah.
Not exactly, but you know, we all do similar things, which is try to figure out people's creative processes. He like considers himself to be in like the therapist mode of songwriter, which isn't coming up with some concept and then writing down A B lines, you know, that fit in like puzzle pieces, but sort of speaking broadly about, you know, he likes to say, like, what's the worst thing that's ever happened in your life? Like, right. Let's write that song, basically. And
if it's that easy, I'll be a producer, guys. Put me in.
I kind of already thought you were.
I think The Archer is a really interesting example of this lyrically, because I think it has some of the strongest Taylor lyrics that we've heard in many years and some of the weakest on the same song. Mm-hmm. You know, they're you know, All My Heroes Die Alone, like that sentiment, which is in the diary entries from many years ago.
I didn't even put that together.
From many years ago, which is amazing.
That was one of, there were maybe three moments in the diary entries that like completely like knocked me off my couch.
Who is she referring to when she said her heroes die alone?
I don't know. It was when she was young.
It's in the same entry where she's talking about Joni Mitchell, who's still alive. But
I was very, that was one of maybe three moments in the diary entries that like just knocked me cold out. And I was blown away by it, because it's such an awful thing for a young person to say. If I was here at my age being like,
people,
all my heroes die alone.
Young people are like melodramatic in diaries. That's the whole point.
Well, yes.
I guess. I thought it was very poignant.
So there's the line about the heroes dying alone. Yeah. There's the all my enemies started out friends, like those sorts of things. And then there's also some cliches, which have started to pop up more in Taylor album. You know, cutting off your nose to spite your face, all the king's horses, all the king's men. Like, that's stuff where I'm puzzled by why she seems to like falling back on those.
Well, I think some of those are more successful than others. I thought cutting off her nose to spite her face and then hating her reflection was actually clever.
Yeah, a good spin.
That's
on.
Yeah,
good,
I thought that was a good one.
Although, here's my question, and this is something, you know, we've all thought about before. Where are the voice notes? Where are the voice memos? Because
there's a couple.
No, there's a couple. But I think some of these songs did not arrive in fully formed packages. The one thing that Taylor has done, it's on this album, it's on the previous album, is how many albums has it been that she's done voice memos as bonus
I think
tracks?
It's just 1989 and this one.
It's was not it, Reputation?
Was it on Reputation?
I don't remember hearing
I'm not
any
sure.
Reputation
So at
ones.
Least two, possibly three albums, Taylor does this thing where as bonus tracks on the album, you know, I guess on the Target editions or whatever, there are voice memos. And what they are effectively full, complete songs. And it's basically a shot at people say, oh, Taylor doesn't write or Taylor can't do this. Or blah, blah.
She's like, I got this little idea and here's the whole thing.
Right, and I just jammed it out and it's on my iPhone.
Which is what the All Too Well lyrics entry in the diaries is as well. It's like, here's when I wrote down a perfect song
with my
bare hands.
And also, frankly, the entire diary conceit is very much in keeping with the voice memo conceit. So I think that the voice memos, quote unquote, of some of these songs that have some of the dubious lyrics would not necessarily arrive like that. I think maybe a fragment of a hook, maybe a full hook, but not a verse, maybe two or three lines here or there, but not a full verse. And then you're sitting in a room and then you think, all the king's horses and all the king's men. And that sort of goes, and then I'll do it again.
This sounds like an invitation for Taylor to do a diary of a song.
Well, I should say here for people who are still listening that the Taylor voice memos from 1989 were my inspiration for starting Diary of a Song. So shout out to Taylor for that. The check is
we're
in
sending,
the mail.
Yeah, she gets 20%.
So I'm curious what you guys think Taylor's relationship with Jack is moving forward. He's worked heavily on three albums. He's become her main collaborator on this album. Do you think they have more mileage in them, or are the fact that you're saying there's six getaway cars on here mean that it's a wrap?
Well, I like them all, but I do think that if she has to, that's just not a problem. That's, I always say, Bad Religion writes one song, and that's a great song. So they can write it as
definitely
many times as they want.
New York Times podcast, definitely the only podcast comparing Taylor Swift to Bad Religion. Just FYI.
Just saying.
Just putting that out there.
But I would say that she has to swerve on the next record. I mean, I think you positioned this very well in your review. It was a transitional record. It's an in-between. It's a resetting. It's a cleanse.
Yeah.
But like, she's going to have to do something next time.
We keep talking about Joni Mitchell Blue. It's in the diaries.
Well, I'm curious about JP. What do you think?
Yeah.
I mean, the electronic side of her explorations is like the Moody, the Archer, False God, that kind of stuff. That seems like a path forward that there's room for her to move in more than
like the bubblecum electronics. You're talking about the Moody electronics.
Yeah, I'm talking about the Moody electronics. Mm. Or more than the, like, let's dip back down in country and have a guitar again. So that's one avenue. But I don't know who I'm trying to think of, which weirdo electronic producer. Maybe you should make an album with Sophie, you know? I mean, just like really push it.
Arca?
Arca. There
wow.
you go.
Lil Michaela.
Wow.
She'll surprise us, though. The thing I worry about on this album is, like, if this album is rewarded for its neatness, then she'll be reinforced to be neater and neater.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I would like the meticulousness, but with a little more strangeness.
I want to talk about this briefly. And, you know, I think we've touched on it with this album. We've touched on it with Reputation. How would this be received if Lover or The Archer were the first single?
Yeah.
I mean, Cruel Summer is the obvious gimme first single, mm-hmm. especially because
it's in the spot on the album.
Yeah, it's in the spot on the album. It's perfect seasonally for when these songs started mm-hmm. coming out. You know, they went with Me, fine. They went with You Need to Calm Down, fine. Both, I think we can agree, sound better now and on the album.
I don't think Me is listenable, but I think You Need to Calm Down is a great song.
Yeah, and also, I just want to point out, I was in the car maybe like two weekends ago, and I was driving and I was listening to, I think it was KTU, and there is a nationally syndicated top 30 remixes program. Like, it's like club remixes. I don't know if they're sanctioned or not. My sense is they're not sanctioned, but there is a version of You Need to Calm Down on that show that was an unrelenting banger. And, like, I did track the MP3 down. I'm sorry. I will post it on Twitter. I don't remember the remixer's name. But it was so fire that it made me go back and reconsider what I was missing.
No, I think
about
we liked the song.
Thing.
We didn't love the video.
It didn't. And I say this in the piece. It's like it was sort of a disservice to the song.
Yes.
Because that video was so heavy-handed. It was so over the top. I mean, we literally immediately did a round it. Like, it was so heavy-handed that we had to comment on it immediately. And
it eclipsed the song.
Yeah. At no point in there were we like, is this bass line any good?
Yes, it was refreshing to hear it when we listened to the album in full. I don't know what we'd say that about me, but... Sorry. But singles-wise, yeah, it would completely change the complexion of how people received it. And this, she's done this the past couple of albums. Like, what do we think the logic is?
Honestly, I don't know. But I do think, like, you know, JP, you keep mentioning the neatness of this album, and I do think it is a very traditional pop album. I mean, something we haven't really mentioned is that, like, it's white music. There's not that much modern music that's not heavily influenced by rap, and that includes Reputation.
Mm-hmm.
But this album feels, you know, I saw Ann Powers did a thread comparing it to girl groups and 90s R&B groups.
Oh, I didn't see that.
I'll take that opinion. I listened to all the links she posted. That's interesting. To me, it still sounds out of step with contemporary culture.
The weird vocal snippet of Idris Elba doesn't.
No, that doesn't count. I do think there are little weird bits on this album. You know, I think Nice to Have a Friend, Death by a Thousand Cuts, mm-hmm. even Paper Rings. You know, there are some, The Archer, I think there are some strange choices here. And I wonder if it was set up differently, if this would be considered a more experimental record than it's being received.
But this is why Paper Rings is so important to me. Because, again, if you think about contemporary white pop music, there is no vanguard. There is no forward-looking artists who are not engaging with hip-hop or the textures of hip-hop or the textures of hip-hop-inflected R&B. It doesn't exist. Taylor...
It's Jack Antonoff.
Yeah.
I was going to say St. Vincent.
Which is the same thing.
Yes.
Sure.
For these purposes.
Yeah, for these purposes. But I do think these songs, and I think your point is totally fair, because she's not leading with them, obviously she's downplaying them, but these are, in many ways, my favorite songs on the record. Not that I need there to be some new wave of what white pop music should sound like outside of the context of hip-hop. Part of the reason a lot of centrist pop music sounds like hip-hop is because hip-hop is the lingua franca of anyone under 25. So that's not surprising necessarily. But I do think hearing her trying to innovate in the spaces around that, I don't think it's a rejection of it. I think it's leaning into maybe what her natural instincts, her gifts, talents are most at home in. And so when I listen to that, I'm intrigued because I think even if there are consonances with girl groups and things like that, I do think there's something about the way that she's approaching it that feels like removed from that. And that, to be fair, apart from what she's done her Reputation, those are the contexts she has ordinarily been most at home in. Should we close out with Death from a Thousand Cuts?
Yeah, I know you had a feeling about this one. What sticks out to you about this track?
So I spent a lot of time when I was listening to this record thinking about Taylor's voice. And we talked earlier about how she uses different vocal approaches on different songs. And I was trying to identify in listening to this record over and over again, which are the uses of her voice where she gets the most mileage from what her natural gifts are. We know that Taylor is not a Beyonce, she's not an Adele, she's not a powerful singer. She has like fundamentally like a pretty thin voice. And I've been trying to figure out, well, how can that thin voice be maximized? And so the two songs to me on this record where it really is maximized are Paper Rings and Death by a Thousand Cuts. And the part of Death by a Thousand Cuts that I like is that on one hand, I do think it's a country song. I think it's like, is this the one I likened to a Kelsey Ballerini song?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, yeah.
He asks his editor.
I just forget. Sorry. Well, at least I know she read the piece. So it's a country song. It feels like it could have come off of the third Taylor Swift album in a weird way, or the second or third Taylor Swift records. But there's a part when they get towards the chorus and then later in the bridge where she's like, you know, I wake up in the morning and you're not my baby. Like that, the way that her voice is stripped free of kind of whatever nonsense, like, you know, production.
Tinkling.
No zhuzhing. There's no zhuzhing. Same thing with the Bridge of Cornelia Street we were talking about with Drake before. When I heard that, I felt this is potentially peak Taylor voice 2019 off of which you could build a new pop identity. That is our show. I mean, is there a better gang to sit around and talk about Lover with? John Pareles, Joe Coscarelli, Karen Gans, and you guys at home. Thank you so much. Listen to every podcast ever, nytimes.com/podcast. Email us at podcast@nytimes.com with the things that you think are Taylor Easter eggs that we have not touched on, or that maybe are not even Easter eggs. What is your favorite lyric off the album? There's like a lot of like hidden gem lyrics in this record, and they are kind of sprinkled in between some less gem lyrics. So tell us the ones that you think are the real bangers. Subscribe to the podcast anywhere you get your audio content: iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, et cetera, et cetera. Our producer in the room, Dan Powell, on the beach, Pedro Rosado, Head Stepper Media. We will be back next week.
Saying goodbye is death by a thousand cuts. Flashbacks waking me up. And get drunk, but it's not enough. Cause the morning comes and you're not my baby. I look through the windows of this love. Even though we...
When it comes to scents, you should pick ones that smell like, well, you. Target gets it, which is why they offer a range of personal care products with fragrances for everyone. Be true to floral you with Dove Peony and Rose Body Wash. Live your fresh life with Degree Ultra Clear Deodorant. Express your decadent side with Love Beauty and Planet Coconut Shampoo. This spring, choose care that brings you joy beyond labels. Pick up new favorites at a Target near you or online at Target.com.